All right, you are listening to the Maker's Quest podcast. I'm Brian Benham.
And I am Greg Porter. And today we are going to talk a little bit of shop safety, but maybe more stories from the old world of things that Brian and I have encountered along our journeys as makers and some of the dangers we've encountered. I would say we're not going to get into a level of gory detail here, but if you have a super weak stomach, you might want to turn away now before it gets too dark for you. But essentially, Brian, I think we're going to share these stories not as a look what happened to me, but as a cautionary tale. I think there's definitely some things in our shop that can reach out and grab us or bite us in ways that maybe we wouldn't know about unless we heard somebody with experience. So as a couple guys with quite a bit of experience, we thought maybe we would share some of those stories to help people out.
Yeah, I think most of the time when I've seen people get hurt that I've worked with, or when I've had close calls myself, is just complacency, or not paying attention is a form of complacency. And then there's always that thing where, like, when you try to force something and it slips, and then bam, you're all of a sudden in trouble. And those are generally the times that I've seen bad things happen.
Well, it's quite obvious when you sit back and think about it, but in the moment, I'll touch on the, when you're forcing something, if something isn't going smoothly, there's generally a reason that it's not going smoothly. And that, you know, applies to screwing in a screw. If it takes a little bit more force than normal, it's usually because there's a burr in there, or there's some thread that's miscut or something. And the same with any kind of rotating, cut your arm off type of equipment. if it's not going perfectly smoothly, there's probably a reason, whether that means the work is pinching the back of your blade or there's something blocking. I know I've seen before table saw fences that aren't square to the blade, or that aren't slightly, I guess, open to the blade, can cause issues where they pinch. And it doesn't always happen in every single material. Sometimes it's, you know, a material that either cuts really, really straight. Some materials cut straighter than others. I don't know how to describe that, but then you get into those situations where if you keep pushing, then it becomes a huge, huge problem. But the complacency side of that, Let's touch on that for a minute, because I think I see it myself in that I do a lot of very, very, very repetitive tasks that don't require any thought. And the one that comes to mind, I've mentioned it before. I make 10,000 of one part every year, and that requires a cut on the table, a cross cut on the table saw. Table saw. Slaw kind of sounds good, actually. But I do 10,000 cross cuts on the table saw, and I do them one after another. There's a stop on there. You don't have to think about it. You just jam the material against the stop, run it through the saw, I take the eraser end of a pencil, and that's how I control the parts coming off. But I wind up having to remind myself about every 5 minutes to just step back from the machine, look up, stretch a little bit, keep your shoulders relaxed, and then, you know, blink a couple times and then get refocused and concentrate back on the work. Because even with those small little parts, it's a 1 inch by 1.5 inch part. Those parts can bind against the blade and cause all kinds of problems. I've had them thrown at me and everything else. And I've had them, even under full concentration and everything else, I've had them just get pinched funny against the stop and the blade, and that can cause huge problems. And the bigger the part, generally the bigger the problem.
Yeah. Also those guys that you're talking about, do you want to name the name of that part? I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah. It's the trim wedge.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. So it's like this little rectangle thing. And so that loose piece could kind of dangle around behind the blade and kick back at you. So I got to ask, I don't know if you have had enough time to really put it through its paces, but you have a saw stop table saw now. And one of the things, every time someone mentions saw stop in a woodworking forum, on a Facebook forum or something, there's this huge fight that breaks out about how people are never going to buy it because they're afraid it's going to make them complacent. So I'm wondering if now that you've had this soft for a while, do you feel like it's making you complacent in your other work?
Yeah. And I'll be honest, I ask myself that all the time. And the way to battle it is to just turn the power off to the saw stop. There's a little key override. Just do that every once in a while. And that'll keep you on your toes. I'm kidding. But so let's go backwards a little bit. Like, why did I buy a saw stop? I had maybe my favorite tool of all time was my table saw. That was my Delta Unisaw. And it was a right tilt Delta Unisaw, which they quit making a long time ago. I think they're all left tilts now. I think universally it's very tough to find a right tilt. I think you have either the same saw or a very, very similar saw that I have. An incredible workhorse. The quality of the saw is as good as it gets, right? Every single cabinet shop in the United States had that saw. And I asked somebody, you know, should I get a saw stop? And somebody said, well, when the cost of losing your fingers exceeds the price of the saw, then it's time to get a saw stop. And so I, you know, it took me a few years for that to really set in. And I asked myself one day, and I didn't have a close call or anything like that. There was no real impetus. It was just, am I to the point in my life where if I lost a finger, it would really set me back in a lot of ways. And, you know, I'm a guitar player and I work with my hands in very fine detail type stuff all the time. And it's like, you know what? I can't afford to lose the tip of a finger, much less the whole thing. And that was what spawned me to really start looking into it and get the saw. I used a saw stop when I was on sabbatical in Boston in 2017. And it was maybe one of the nicest saws I'd ever used. And I've said that before, I think on this show, that the quality of the saw stop is what's so attractive. Take the amputational piece of the saw stop away, and the saw is a fantastic saw. It's very well made, very well balanced, super smooth, very powerful, all of the things that you need in a table saw. So that was the reason I bought one. But I can tell you that I've used a table saw for, I'm going to say 40 years. It might be a little less than that. I grew up on a radial arm saw, which is even better. Way more dangerous, because that saw rotates in the same way that you're pulling it through your work. Like, it just wants to eat you alive. And I started using the radial arm saw. It came from my grandfather. And I want to say I was maybe like 11 years old when I started using that under my dad's supervision. But then I would sneak off when he wasn't around and use it and clean up and make sure he didn't know. But so the table saw, when I got it, I was like, man, this is so much safer than what I'm used to. And it was. And I've always approached that tool from a very safe perspective. Like, if your hands are anywhere near that saw, why don't you have a push block in your hands? And there are some situations where you know, you have to deal with your own comfort level, but there are some situations where it's like, you know what, a push stick is actually going to make this situation maybe more dangerous. So where are you at? Right. And you got to really take your time. And when you're doing something like that, be ultra aware. With the saw stop, I approach it the exact same. I don't want to ever set that saw stop off for two reasons. I don't want to trust it. And number two, I don't want to have to pay for the cartridge and the saw blade because I'm cheap, just like my dad's cheap. So from that perspective, I know I haven't lost a step now. I'm what, 6 months into my saw stop, I think. I don't think I'm going to lose that. And it's because it's so tightly ingrained in my brain. And I really don't want to test it out. I don't want to have that first accident with the saw stop. I don't want to be one of those people that puts their cut finger on Instagram. That is totally unappealing to me, Brian.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, I guess, give me your thoughts on, you don't have a saw stop. You have a Unisaw like I used to have.
Mm-hmm.
And when you approach that saw, tell me what that's like in terms of why that might be different than what I would, or someone with a saw stop might do.
Yeah. So I'm very much a creature of habit. And I think if you start out with good habits, and I think that's kind of something that we've may have lost a little bit in America with schooling, because we don't have like the shop classes as much as we used to, or it's not as prevalent as it once was. And, or you don't have the dads that, have the tools to show the kids how to do it, because of course now everything is a throwaway society and sauced up. We're getting off into the weeds with that thought. But one thing that, being a creature of habit, that I don't even really think about it anymore, because I approach the saw the same every single time. On almost all the cuts are all the same. I generally have it ingrained in my brain that if I'm getting below 2 inches ripping a cut, I need to get my push stick. And I've built a little tool holder that has my push stick hanging right there, so I can just reach up and grab it. Even if I forget and I've already started the cut, I can just reach up there and grab it. So it's just like this huge habit thing for me. With that said, I think that just naturally, we adjust to our situation. So like, if I'm cutting a circle out of a piece of plywood on the bandsaw and I have the bandsaw guard all the way down to cut that plywood, I'm feeling very safe. But if I'm taking a big rough log that doesn't sit very flat on the table of the bandsaw, and I'm trying to make it round so I could put it on the lathe and turn a bowl, and I have the guard all the way up and this huge 12 inch thing of blade exposed, now all of a sudden that same tool, I'm freaking out. I'm butt puckering the whole time as I'm trying to cut that out. So I think we just naturally adjust to our surroundings, especially if you have experience and you've seen things go wrong. Like if you've ever tried to cut something round the round way on a bandsaw, that gets sketch real fast.
Yeah. thinking about stories I've heard from other people, one of the guys that I encountered out in Boston at the Autodesk Build Space, he was a shop teacher. And so one day he was just going on about what had happened in his shop under his supervision-ish. And somebody tried to slice a baseball in half on the bandsaw and lost a finger doing that one, because it just yanks the baseball from you and pulls your hand right into the blade. So that was interesting. But let's talk, we were going to talk a little bit about maybe injuries, but situations that we've been in that have been dangerous, that could have produced maybe some terrible results that maybe didn't. One of the things that I would share on the table saw in particular, you've been over to my shop. My shop is really tight. My outfeed is kind of awkward for my table saw. It's not as nice as I would like it to be, but essentially on the offcut side of the table saw, my offcuts just fall to the floor. And on the fence side, sometimes, most of the time, they sit on my outfeed table. So I would say probably one of the most dangerous things I've encountered, and I deal with it now by putting some type of a work hold or something behind my table saw on the offcut side. But I often will pull those offcuts in because I'm getting ready to cut another strip out or something like that. And I've had the backs of my offcuts hit the blade while it's still spinning and on, because I do have a habit of leaving my table saw on as long as I'm making cuts, right? Mm-hmm. And you get really used to that blade spinning. And if you drop something on that blade, it just becomes a 200 mile an hour projectile. Yeah. And it will scare you. It will not only ruin that piece of lumber, but it will scare the absolute crap out of you. The good news is your hands are generally nowhere near the blade, so you're not in grave danger that way of having an amputation, but you can really get hurt by those projectiles. So bringing material in the air across your blade, terrible idea in general. And then along those same lines, maybe one of the worst things that's ever happened on the table saw to me was when my wife was out in the shop. And you can probably attest to this. When you have a really well-balanced table saw running, you can barely hear it. It's mm-hmm. just a whir.
Yeah.
And you can't see that it's running. And my wife was out there. Again, I was probably cutting a few hundred of the same parts, so I just had the table saw running. And she came out and was asking me questions and just kind of off to the side. And I was talking to her, you know, about what the answer was. And she started reaching across the table saw blade for something that was on the other side of it. And she got her hand completely over the spinning saw blade. And I thought, if I say something to her right now, it's going to scare her. Mm-hmm. And she's going to get into that blade. So I'm going to let her reach and get what she's going to get and pull her hand back. And then I'm going to turn the blade up. And she was an inch from the spinning blade. Now, I would have knocked her out of the way had she come any closer, but she was about an inch away from that blade, and it scared the absolute bejesus out of me. But sometimes the safety things are not our personal safety, but our spouse or our kids or mm-hmm. a visitor to the shop who's not used to being around running equipment. I also have a tendency to leave the drill press running for hours at a time while I drill. I have some projects that require 4,000 holes at a time, and that's not an exaggeration. It's 4,000 holes. And so I'll leave the drill press running literally for an entire day because I'm just drilling parts, and then I move baskets of parts, and then I, you know, drill more parts until I can't stand anymore. And if somebody doesn't understand that that drill press is running, the drill press can be a really dangerous tool, believe it or not. It's not going to cut a hand off, but it can definitely strangle you. It can leave bruises. It can pull your clothing in and all the other horrible things that you hear about shop class.
Yeah, I've left my joiner. I shouldn't say I've left it. I have left it on many times because my joiner is very quiet. Like you get, it's an 8-inch joiner. And the bigger the machine you get, you think the louder it would get, but it's not because it's belt driven and it's heavy. And so there's not as much vibration. So the joiner is pretty silent when you're wearing hearing protection. You can't really hear the motor running and the dust collector running. So it's just, you know, background noise. I've quit for the day and took my hearing protection off, shut the dust collector off, and then realized the joiner has been running for the last 2 hours while I was doing other things in the shop. That's happened to me a lot just because it's so quiet.
Well, that would make a heck of a racket if you laid your beer can on there like everybody tends to do, right?
Yeah, well, thank God I have the lamb chop guard. Yeah. So it's the blade's always covered, but yeah.
Yeah, that's that's pretty crazy. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about, because you've mentioned this before, that when we're woodworkers or we're makers of any kind, you can look at somebody's non-dominant hand, and essentially your whole life is your dominant hand trying to kill your non-dominant hand. And I've heard you say that maybe more than once. And I guess some of those thoughts probably come from some experience. So just shed some light on where that theory comes from, Brian.
Well, when I was a kid, I was probably 10 years old or something. And I was getting into woodworking because that was when I was 10, I think was when the new Yankee Workshop started on PBS. So it was a big deal. And I thought this was really cool. This is what I'm going to do. Right. Like Norm had a huge effect on me, but my mom had this rule, like, you can't use any of your dad's power tools unless he's there supervising you or when he gets home from work. She's like, I'm not taking you to the emergency room, you know, and have to explain that. I let this 10-year-old kid use a radio arm saw was what we had in the garage. And so I was like, okay, well, that's fine. Roy Underhill's also pretty cool. He's all hand tools all the time. So I can go build some stuff with hand tools. And I was trying to pry or carve something with a chisel, and I slammed that into my thumb, and I cut it. That chisel was nice and super sharp because Roy Underhill has also a great instructional episode on sharpening chisels. So I sliced that thing all the way down to the bone, and it was like an inch and a half across the cusp of my thumb, or the crook of my thumb right there. And so my mom ended up having to take me to the emergency room to get my first set of stitches at 10. And then of course they had all kinds of questions, like, is this abuse? Because, you know, when you go to the emergency room, and you're taking your kid there, they want to make sure it's not abuse. So of course my mom had to endure all that fun stuff. But that's kind of where I've come to that conclusion, that no matter what, your dominant hand is trying to kill your non-dominant hand.
Well, you touched on another point that I hear a lot of people make, and you probably have as much experience as anybody I know, using tools that have to be sharpened. But the rule that I was taught was there's nothing more dangerous than a dull tool.
Mm-hmm.
And which makes me think, well, the sharper you make them, the safer they become. But is that really true?
Yeah, I 100% think that's true. So I don't want to say the guy's name because he is a very, very talented woodworker. And I follow him on TikTok. And he was having this debate with this other woodworker about how tall you should have your blade. And the other woodworker said, well, my table saw blade's only a little bit taller than the material I'm cutting because I think that's safer. And then he was saying, well, if you raise your blade up, the centrifugal force of the blade is going to push the material down onto the table. So it's not going to likely ride up. And I was like, man, I feel like this guy's just making it up just to make a video because he's going from woodworker to content creator now, and which is a sad thing in itself. I enjoyed his woodworking content, but now he's like going off the rails saying that you should have your blade super high. And I was thinking, well, there's two things that I think are the two most important things you should learn as a woodworker is one, sharp tools. So if your blade is sharp, it's going to cut fast and it's not going to allow you to push so fast that it's going to push that blade, that board up to right up on top of the blade or right up on the blade. And two, approach your work with finesse. So you need to adjust your speed based on what you're cutting. So if you're cutting a really dense wood, you need to slow your rate of feed down versus softwood where you can push really fast. So if you have a dull blade, you have to slow your feed rate way down more than what you think you're going to do. So I was just like, man, this guy is like losing my respect points by his video because he's missing the two most important things of woodworking, and that's keep it sharp and approach with finesse.
Well, and I guess I go back to, right, it's a poor carpenter who blames his hammer, and you should be able to make less than optimal tools work for you, but it requires that attention. Like you said, you know, listen to the feedback that the tool is giving you, and it will tell you faster or slower mm-hmm. most of the time. But as far as the other tools go, I would ask Brian, like where have you found maybe not the most danger in the shop? I think you could point that out pretty quickly, but where have you found the tool or the area of the shop that has caused maybe the most close calls for you?
Oh, the router table all day long. The router table is when something catches fast and it'll blow out a piece, it'll tear up a piece, it'll kick it out of your hands if you're not careful. The router table is right up there. I haven't really had any scary things because I think the first time it happened to me, I was like, okay, I need to approach this with much more respect. So it's kind of like that, having the bandsaw blade guard up cutting the wobbly log, like you got to really like keep your wits about you. So now, like, once I had that first piece in grain catch on a piece and blow it apart in my hands, I was like, okay, this tool needs more respect. I need to slow my roll way down and take a lot more caution with it and learn how to operate this safely and implement more things. The second tool is the lathe, and that is just because I don't have the experience on the lathe. Same kind of thing. When you're turning, you get catches, and that's totally normal turning to get catches. But the lathe has hurt me a couple of times. A couple of times I've had things fly off and hit me in the face. Luckily, I have a face shield. The one time that I thought for sure I was going to the emergency room is the lathe was spinning, and I had the tool rests. I needed to adjust it down, and so I unlocked it because it has a little knob that ties down and then just lower it down, and it's still spinning, and my hands are way away from it because the top of the tool rest is up here where it's spinning and I'm adjusting it way down here. But the tool rest swung a little bit and hit the workpiece that's spinning, and it slammed the tool rest down onto my hand and like pinched it between that banjo thing and the side of the tool rest, and I thought for sure I broke my finger, but it was okay. I just had a blood blister like the full side of my full length of my finger for a couple of weeks.
That's brutal. I want to go back to the router table because this is one I think about all the time. And I spend a lot of time. I have a setup just like, not just like, but similar to what David Marks had and has. I'm sure he still has it. But in the Woodwork series, that was where I saw it the first time, the table saw and the router table sharing a fence, sharing a surface. And I can remember seeing it the first time thinking, that is genius. And of course, this was before YouTube and everything else. Like, so you just didn't, you didn't get to peek into other woodworker shops unless you had like woodworking magazine or whatever that was, Popular Woodworks. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah, there's a couple of them.
Yeah. And you know, every once in a while my mom was shopping for groceries, I'd go in the magazine section and peek through the woodworking magazines, but they rarely showed shop layouts like that and in detail, right? Like you would see a picture of a guy working at a table saw, but you wouldn't get the context around it. And so from that point forward, it was like, oh, this is a very powerful combination, right? And you learn all those lessons on the router in the first week that you use the router table. But flipping that around and doing as much work as I do on a CNC machine. A CNC is just a router that's upside down, right?
Mm-hmm.
You not never, but you almost never have those same situations with a CNC machine. And the question is why? And I've thought about it a lot. And when I look at dangerous situations on the CNC mill that I have, so the machining end of things, the Tormach versus the wood router, versus a router table, it almost always comes up to a vibration and chatter issue. So on the milling machine, if you have, you can see it in the surface finish, right? If you want that mirror surface finish around your part, it has to be clamped incredibly tight and everything has to be perpendicular, parallel, all the things, right? And when I look at the CNC router end of things, if you don't have your work bolted down in a fashion that is very tight and doesn't allow any movement or vibration, you can get those same, you know, cutting out of end grain and flinging a part across the room. I've had to duck before because parts were coming off the CNC machine. And that is a scary situation when you have, again, that much power and force behind something that's just launching off across the room. But on the router table itself, I have found a couple things that if you're going to be cutting end grain and doing some sketchy things, number one, tool stick out is a thing. And then do you have a straight cutting tool or is your tool shearing at an angle? That's incredibly important as well. You want an angled tool. Angled tools can still cause you the same blowout, tear out problems that will tear parts from your hands. But if you're moving a part on the router table and you're able to put it in some kind of fixture that allows you more downward pressure to keep the vibration from happening in the part, because if you're just using your fingers, that vibration comes up through your fingers. At least that's been my experience, where if you're using a DeStaco type clamp or something like that, it takes that vibration out and really solidifies the part. Anyway, and that also puts a couple more inches between you and the cutter when you can have a fixture like that. But I found way more success on using my router table in that way, that you do everything you can to take the vibration out of the cut. And that helps tremendously in terms of tear out and tearing parts out of your hands as well.
Yeah, work holding. And then like the gantry of like a CNC machine is very rigid. Will give you a lot cleaner cut. Like you can climb cut all day long on a CNC machine and it doesn't know the difference, but you climb cut on a router, if you're not careful on a handheld router, you're going for a run.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so again, talking about dangers, let's talk about CNC machines for a second.
Right.
They're safe in that your hands are nowhere near the moving tools most of the time, right? Like the only time that happens, if you're doing tool changes and things like that, and I can tell you, I've cut the back of my hands on sharp tools sitting in the CNC router more times than I care to admit. And same with the CNC mill. If you're not paying attention and your hand slips up underneath the tool changer, even when the machine's completely powered off. You can give yourself stitches or super glue situations pretty darn easy. But what I found is one of the real dangers that new CNC users don't see coming is the parts within parts. So say I'm cutting out a profile that either has a circle in the middle of, like if I was cutting out a donut, right? There's a circle in the middle and there's a circle around the outside. Or if you're cutting some angular pieces, then you're laying out six or seven of them on a sheet. There's the piece that's not part of your piece. It's the waste. And keeping control of that waste is every bit as important as keeping control of the part you want to make. I've had several occasions where those parts have broken free and just flown across the room, or they get stuck up in the bit, and then they cause that to create a whole different kind of havoc on the machine, where it just starts tearing whatever sheet you have, either clamped or bolted or double stick taped down, however you're holding your work. And again, you can not only lose your part, but you know, when that sheet starts spinning, that's a crazy thing to see. You know, half a sheet or a quarter sheet of plywood start spinning on a machine. It's very, very dangerous to be around. And then sometimes with that spinning bit, if a piece gets caught on there, you can't hardly hit the emergency stop button because you can't get close enough to it because there's parts spinning and you can't get your hands in there. So I would say that's one area of the shop. The other thing on the CNC machine, then I'll stop for a second, is the dust boot that we like to have on our CNC machines. We like to make them very easily removable. So a lot of them are held on by magnets. And I think I've had three of them now come loose in the middle of an operation and get caught up in the router bit and then fling across the room. And those dust boots on, I know the Avid one weighs, it's made out of acrylic and it's like two layers of half inch or three quarter inch acrylic. It's super heavy. And I got hit by it one time in the hand. And I thought, just like you, I thought I was going to the emergency room with a broken hand. It hit me that hard.
Ouch. Yeah. Did you swell up? Big swelling up?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it was black and blue. Everybody thought I got in a fight. I'm like, no, I'm way, nice. Way beyond those years.
Yeah. All right, so we started the podcast saying we were gonna talk about some horse shows.
Yeah,
you got one.
Oh my goodness. You know, I've been in. I like to say I've narrowly escaped death a number of times in my life, and once literally by an inch or two on, almost got hit on the highway. Not being in a car as a pedestrian, almost got hit by a car going sideways at about 70 miles an hour. But in the shop, probably some of the scariest things that I've had have not been the rotating tools or things of that nature. It's probably been more on the automotive side of things and getting pinched in between something where you can't get loose. And that is the scariest of scary things, when you can't reach your phone because you can't move your arms, or you can't get your feet free because your feet are trapped underneath something that's too heavy to lift. I've had a few automotive lifts in my life. I have one now in my garage, and that can actually be one of the most dangerous things because it can crush you and you don't have any way to escape. And when I do a lot of my welding and steel work, I wear steel-toed boots. Thank God. And I would advise everyone. And I started wearing my steel-toed boots, not because I was afraid of losing toes, but because I like to kick steel things, because sometimes that's an easy way to move something that's heavy, is you just kind of kick it. And two or three times of that in tennis shoes or some other kind of street shoes, and you'll learn that steel-toed boots are definitely the move, because you can still kick things and not make your toenails fall out. But I have had my feet pinched underneath an automotive lift, and that was ridiculously scary because I couldn't reach the hydraulic buttons and I couldn't move. So then all you do is you yell and scream until somebody can get you out. And thankfully, my wife was able to come out, push the button and get me free, which you, it's like the stupidest thing in the world. How did your feet get trapped underneath the lift? Well, I thought I had plenty of clearance. And, but anyway, there was a situation I was in where I absolutely couldn't get my feet out. Nice. How about you, Brian?
All right. So I think I want to tell a couple of stories from when I worked bridge construction, because bridge construction, everything is big. Everything is gnarly. I started working there when I was 13. So, I had the, I'm not sure if the pleasure, but opportunity to work with some, people that have seen it all, you know, insurance company, we know a thing or two, cause we've seen a thing or two. So some of these old guys, and so they would like, don't let the kid get hurt was kind of the thing. Right. So I was always constantly giving a safety talk, but when the safety talk was over and we went to work, some of those guys didn't follow their own advice. And so I've seen a lot of unfortunate things happen. So I'm going to kind of rapid fire a couple, three stories here. First story, we built, one of our contracts was to build these portable logging bridges, and we would deck them with these big wooden beams as the drive surface. And so we'd stack them up and we'd drill through three-quarter inch auger bit. And if you stack them all up, you could drill through. And so they're all, you only have to lay out the top one. You could drill through a couple of them at a time and save yourself some layout time. So this guy's drilling through with this 3/4 inch auger bit, but the bottom beam starting to move as it's starting to come through, but it won't come through. So of course he's trying to force it now, and he kicks his foot underneath there to help steady it as he pushes down. And he happened to be putting his foot right where the bit was coming through and drilled into the top of his foot with a 3/4 inch auger bit. And of course it sucked his foot up to it, because that's how that geometry works. And so now he's pinned himself to this beam and he's freaking out. And like, he had to like stop from freaking out to be like, okay, I need to unstick myself. So he had to put the drill in reverse and back it back out of his foot. So, he had several surgeries for that guy.
Awesome.
So now another wonderful story is, radio arm saw deal. The guy's wearing gloves because this wood is pressure treated, and we had this big radio arm saw, and it wasn't like your little 10 inch radio arm saws. This thing had like some kind of 20 inch blade on it, so you could really cut through a big beam. Caught the edge of the glove on his thumb, and it sucked his thumb into the blade, and it didn't cut his thumb off because the glove just sucked up along there, but it like cut all along from tip of his thumb down to his wrist. And so he had to have it all stitched back together.
That was
a pretty gross one. So that was like, I never wear gloves after I saw that. Never, ever, ever wear gloves. And then probably one of the really gnarly ones, because it involved the most blood, and like you could see like the bone and things, was we had this thing called an iron worker. So it was basically like this big shear. So it could shear like a piece of 3/4 inch piece of metal in half. And it had a guard on there, so that way you don't put your hands in there, right? So this guy is trying to shear a piece that's too small to shear. It's kind of like a stick. If you want to break a stick in half, it's a big stick. You can easily break in half, but a little piece, you can't break in half so much. So he had this piece of metal up there real close, and he had his fingers right underneath that guard there, but not all the way. And he hit the button, the shear came down, and it flipped that. Instead of shearing it, it flipped the metal up because it was so short, and smashed his fingers between the guard and the material. And man, that was a mess. It broke it. Like the bone was like in like 3 or 4 different pieces. It was like just like this. His finger was like this bag of busted bones.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah.
Well,
that's bridge construction for you. That's just the tame ones. There's some other ones where people have lost their lives, but we don't need to go into that.
Well, I shared, Brian, before we started the podcast here tonight, my good friend who does my machining production work almost lost his hand in his Tormach last year. And it was one of those things, you know, to talk about complacency and paying attention and those sort of things. And he just happened to stick his hand in the machine when it was moving and was just clearing some chips out, you know, kind of keeping the machine clean. And next thing he knows, the table has got his hand pinched, and it has him pinched in a situation where he can't reach the e-stop button. And thankfully it didn't travel all the way down to where it just pinched his hand off, but he wound up having stitches from essentially his thumb all the way across the underside of the palm of his hand. And you know, lucky that the injury was what it was, but I think probably the most egregious part of the whole thing was it took him 3 hours to clean all the aluminum chips out of the cut, because his hand was down in the middle of a, you know, big pile of chips that he was trying to clean. And so they had to sit and pick chips out for 3 hours with a set of tweezers to get them all out so that they didn't sew them into his hand. But I did want to mention one of the other things that was maybe one of the most dangerous things, maybe one of the most dangerous things that's happened in my shop. And it reminded me of the fireworks. What do they call them? Like weasel chasers or something like that, where you light the end of them and they, you know, chase you around.
Yeah.
I had a, should I name it by name? I don't know. I had a router lift from a very popular company, and put my router in there, had it in my router table for, I'm going to say it was a solid year. Maybe it was a little bit more than a year. And I didn't have a dust collection box under it, right? I had a shop vac that I would just kind of vacuum everything up, just let the chips fly where they fly. And one day the basket that holds the router in place, the screws, I guess the set screws had just slowly backed themselves out. And one day, as I was using that router, the nice thing about routers are they have these really nice long cords so that you can take them around your workpiece, and it came loose. And that router fell down and hit the floor while it was on. And it just started dancing around while I was standing in front of it. And the cord was long enough that it didn't unplug itself like most tools would when they're in a runaway situation. So here I am trying to turn the power off to the router. And in order to get to that, you kind of had to jump over this dancing router. it's one of those. And of course, when you unplug it, it takes like 30 seconds to wind down or something. So like the fear is still there as the machine even loses its power. But anyway, that's one of those things that when that happened, I went out and bought a dust collector bucket thing for underneath of it, that if that ever happened again, at least the router would be contained inside of a cage and not be chasing me around the garage.
Yeah. That is similar, very similar situation. Before I had a router table, you know, you could just, you know, a lot of guys take the router, the handheld router, and just screw it to the bottom of a piece of plywood. And when I first got started, I had no money to buy any kind of router lift. So that's what I had. And I forgot to tighten it down once I adjusted the height, and I turned it on and it spun out of that thing. And it cut the cord, big sparks and smelly smoke, because it cut the cord and blew the breaker. And
good fun. Well, you know, we always think that the danger in the router table is on top of the table, and quite honestly, there's as much danger under the table as there is above the table. You just don't get to it very often, but man, when that happens, it's a scary thing.
So do we want to end it on that note? That's kind of a funnier note than the blood and the gore.
I'd say that's as good a place as any to end it, Brian. It's been great. Number one, just seeing around the corner a little bit, right? The only time that we learn a lot of things by touching the hot burners, right, in our lives. And so being able to learn from other people's experience, I think, is incredibly valuable to keep us from making the same mistakes. And, you know, that goes back to our parents trying to teach us all the mistakes they made so we wouldn't make the same ones. But we deal with very dangerous situations in our shops and in our garages. And so just being able to get an extra leg up, I think, is a huge advantage. So we'll cut it off there. I am Greg Porter. You can find me at Greg's Garage and Skyscraper Guitars on both YouTube and Instagram.
And I'm Brian Benham, and you can find me on all the socials at Benham_design or brianbenham.com. And you're listening to the Maker's Quest podcast. If you want to listen to any of our old episodes, go to themakersquest.com. Thanks for listening.